And so in the appropriate choice of variables, this was just written as an integral, the eta, d3x, and using this Mokanov's variable, nu, just nu prime square, and then plus nu. So big change, I'm writing nabla nu square, but I integrate it by parts, so I'm writing nu, nabla square nu, just to have some fun, and then plus a nu. And so this was the action for that, and then we have seen that you can basically choose the basis, which is given by the Fourier transformation plus it was some unknown function fk, and this function fk actually obeys Mukhanov's equation. And so once we solve this equation, we can calculate the power spectrum. So the power spectrum, here. So for those who came now, this is just a brief recapitulation of what we have done a long time ago, meaning something like 20 minutes ago. So the power spectrum here is just given by f k square over a square, where this f of k solves Mukhanov's equation. Equation which is fk plus a square plus a double prime over a f of k equals to zero, provided to some initial conditions in plus Bunch-Davis vacuum, saying that in the infinite past, f of k, this term disappeared, and you had just the standard time, standard thing here. So at early times f of k is just 1 over 2k minus ik eta. Okay? And then specifically, we have seen that for the Descitel space, which is a particular case of this, so specifically for Descitel inflation, you get that this f of k square is given by 1 over 2k cube eta square. And so this is how this 1 over k cube spectrum emerges. So this is proportional to 1 over k cube, which is the scale invariant spectrum. Okay, so this is what we have seen last time. So by the way, regarding your homework, I put the date for Monday, but I realized that unfortunately it's holiday, so give it to me on Tuesday. I changed the date for that, so you don't have to come here on holiday. Okay, so this is what we have done in the previous lecture. So we trained a lot, we were going up and down the mountain, now we are in the camp 4, and let's do the real thing. So let's sum it now. So what you want to do is you want to actually calculate really the real stuff. And the real stuff is not a test scalar field, but actually you have to take into account that this test scalar field back reacts on the geometry, and so it can actually change the geometry as well. So you have to actually study the coupled perturbations, which are scalar tensor perturbations. So the real calculation is you have to study coupled scalar tensor perturbations. And of course, course, that allows for possibility of producing gravitational waves. So in some sense, you introduce a scalar field to drive your inflation, but as the inflation proceeds, actually the expansion of the universe can cause that some gravitational waves are produced. And so we have, we will have also some tensor power spectrum, so you know how much perturbations in the metric are generated, and you can, yeah, think about them as gravitational waves. Okay, so in order to do that, you have to really consider the full action. So now it's 1 over 16 pi g newton. Well, I denoted m Planck square with small letter m. It was 8 pi m Planck square, or 8 pi g newton. So then you'll still have 1 half. So anyway, so this is the action, so this is the Einstein-Hilbert action, and then you have the scalar field, and in principle, this scalar field can have some potential here. Okay? So, again, you will take as your background, you will take FRW spacetime with k equal to zero geometry. So the background is some, you know, g mu nu, which is FRW with k equal to zero, and we will have field phi, which is only a function of time, which is the unperturbed in photon, if you want. Okay. But now you allow to perturb both of these things. So you know, you want to consider perturbations so g mu nu will have g mu nu plus h mu nu. That's my perturbation of the metric, and phi is something which can be spatial fluctuating, and you know, whatever, small phi. Okay, so now the problem is gravity, is that gravity is a gauge theory, and so actually to extract the true degrees of freedom, you have to gauge fix. Okay, so to extract true degrees of freedom, needs to gauge fix. And so basically that was the origin of big confusion of cosmological perturbation theory. So people could do it sort of for the calculation I'll reproduce here for, you know, this Gaussian and two-point functions. But people couldn't do it like really nicely, consider higher point functions and stuff like that. And it was only when Mandasino actually showed the way, in some sense, how to do this. Okay, so you need to gauge fix. And so what you expect is that you produce some gravitational waves and you have a scalar field. So in principle, and you know that the gravitational waves have 2 degrees of freedom, and the scalar field has 1 degree of freedom. So you need to extract 3 degrees of freedom, which are really there. And so the best way to actually gauge fix is to do some clever trick how you write down equations. So what you have to do is that you take this action, you plug in the g mu nu plus h mu nu, and you plug in phi plus phi, and then you need to expand this action into a quadratic order in these perturbations. So only if you expand into the quadratic order, then you can actually study the relevant perturbations. Okay. So.
David, one question.
Yeah.
So we were describing everything from the commoving frame. doesn't that fix the gauge? At least some part of it?
Well, I fixed the gauge for, in some sense, I fixed the gauge for this guy, but yeah, you have now a perturbation. And mm-hmm. so it's the same thing as if you study gravitational waves, right?
Okay.
So you said that G mu nu is just eta mu nu, right? And then you are gauge fixing this guy here mm-hmm. to extract really two polarizations of the graviton in some sense. So now you have basically the same thing, but it's a little bit more complicated because now you have, in addition to that, you have scalar field, which is also perturbed. So it's like studying gravitational waves and gauge fixing these, you know, extra these things. So these are fixed. These are fixed. This is fine.
Okay.
But now you have to gauge fix the perturbations. And so the best way is to do this scalar vector tensor decomposition. And that's like a basis of a basics of cosmological perturbation theory. So many cosmologists will tell you that when they first saw this cosmological perturbation theory, they decided to do a different subject because it's not very neat. It's actually, you know, it's a lot of pain to go through this cosmological perturbation theory. But yeah, on the other hand, if you talk to Matt Johnson, he says the most beautiful thing on the Earth. So anyway, so they are. So what do you have to do? Best thing is that you decompose your perturbation H mu nu into the scalar vector and tensor components. So H mu nu decomposes into, with respect to time, so you introduce one scalar, so you call H00 a scalar phi, and then you call H0y components, and so this is like a three vector, and you decompose it into this transverse vector, vi, and then di of another scalar b, and finally you take hij to be a square gamma ij, this is transverse and traceless guy, and then plus 2 times di wj symmetrized, and then di dj another scalar, and 2 zeta delta ij. So now this is the part you have seen when we were discussing the polarization. So how to decompose a 2 tensor into this SVT decomposition. And so you have, so this guy is, for example, transverse and traceless. That means that di gamma ij equals to 0, and then gamma ii equals to 0. And, you know, similarly, this will be true for this guy. So it will be di wi equals to 0. And for vi as well, di vi equals to 0. So that's the decomposition of the metric. And then you have your scalar phi. So that's an additional degree of freedom. So in some sense, you trade your descriptions in terms of h mu nu and phi in terms of these, you know, many scalars. So you have scalar here, you have scalar here, scalar here, scalar here. Then you have some nice vectors and some nice tensors. So now what is actually why you are doing this is that, surprisingly, if you start plugging these things, the modes do not talk to each other. So in some sense, the modes, so this is useful because by these traceless and, you know, transverse conditions and stuff like that, the modes decouple. And can be treated separately. Okay, so now you take this decomposition, you plug it into the action, and you expand everything to the quadratic order in these perturbations. Okay? So the next step would be, you know, plug into action, and expand quadratic order. Both of pain. Okay. And then you will really find that because of these conditions, really the modes sort of decouple. So now once you have that, you can start gauge fixing. And so the simplest way to do the thing is called zeta gauge. So after you do that, you know, you gauge fix. And so particularly nice is zeta gauge. Of course, you know, the gauge fixing is also the reason why none of the papers agree with each other, because everybody was using different gauge, right? So then the results cannot be really compared, because you are having different things. Okay, so zeta gauge is such that actually you choose that the scalar field does not fluctuate at all, and so it's just given by the background thing. And you can sort of do that, right? So the fluctuations of the field you can sort of mimic by fluctuations of the metric, and that's fine, right? So phi is equal to zero, and then actually you can gauge away many of these scalars and vectors and stuff like that. And so the only non-trivial thing, so and the degrees of freedom are entirely captured by two things, is by this zeta scalar and by your gamma ij. So now this has 2 degrees of freedom, this has 1 degree of freedom, this has 3 true degrees of freedom in your description. Okay, so this is called zeta gauge. Okay, and again, this is a lot of pain, right, to show that I can really, you know, express everything in terms of these two, you know, that's a lot of pain. Yeah?
Could you repeat how we can get rid of the scalar field perturbation?
Oh, you can. Why not? So you can just, you know, mimic the scalar, well, you can just mimic the perturbations of the scalar field by, let's say, changing time or, you know, changing space. So you're introducing some fluctuations into the space-time, and you can say, well, this basically mimics the scalar field, what scalar field does for you. Yeah, you can do that. Okay, so we have this, and then the miraculous result is, and why this zeta gauge is actually useful, is that these two perturbations actually satisfy a very nice equation. So now you can write down the action, you know, following from that action, expanded into the quadratic order in these perturbations. And so it splits into two parts. So it's m Planck square over 8, an integral d4 of x, a cube. And then you are getting something very, very simple. You are getting gamma ij dot derivative with respect to normal time t, a square gamma ij nabla square gamma ij. And for the scalar, you are getting m Planck square, and I probably missed nominal, here we go, d4 of x, and then a cube. And there is a teeny tiny difference, but which is, however, very important. Suddenly, the epsilon parameter, which is the slow roll parameter, which we have, you know, described our inflation with, emerges here. And so here it's just zeta dot square plus 1 over a square zeta nabla square. Okay, so this thing here where this epsilon is just the slow roll parameter. So this is great. So now you have, well, epsilon, I just remind you, is minus h dot over 8 squared. This is how we defined it some time ago. And for a scalar field, it's just the ratio of the kinetic energy of the scalar field with respect to the total energy. M Planck square, 8 squared. Okay? So this is the result. And if you don't believe what I just said here, you're welcome to go through your homework, and all the details are there. Okay, yeah?
I think in the S gamma, some brackets are missing.
Are there? S gamma.
So what does gamma ij dot contract with?
Square, yes.
R square.
Thanks. It's gamma ij dot, gamma ij dot. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for that. That would be strange if we had a tensor there. Okay, so you know, if you are interested in the details of the calculation, then go through your homework. You will do this cosmological perturbation theory in the exploration course. So you know, you can wait until then, once you really get familiar with this cosmological perturbation theory, how it works. And yeah, this will be, you will see it enough there, I think. Anyway, so this is the result. So once we arrive at this wonderful conclusion, and that's where your homework starts, you are almost done. Okay? So now you can start studying what really happens, what is the power spectrum of the scalars here, of the zeta scalar, and what is the power spectrum of this gamma. Okay? So let me first do scalars. And so you see that equation is, you know, remarkably similar to the equation which we are getting just for test scalar field, right? So the only difference is, well, okay, this is not good. I just wrote that one there. Okay, sorry for that. But if you start with the original scalar field equation, then they would be remarkably similar. So all you have to do is that you change dt to d eta, and then you introduce Mukhanov variable nu, which is z times zeta, where z square is just 2a square m Planck square and epsilon. And if you do that, this action over here just rewrite in a very, very simple form, and exactly in the form we have over there, d eta 1 half nu prime square plus nu nava square nu plus z nu equal to that. Okay, so if you use this change of variables, you just rewrite it in terms of the test scalar field. So we have done all the work now, and so we know that the power spectrum of this is just given by this fk square divided by z square. Now, so the only thing you have to replace is just a with z. Otherwise, everything is the same. Okay, so fk again, it solves this Mukhanov's equation. Okay. So now there is no surprise. So what you will do next is to get, again, some estimate what this power spectrum looks like. And in principle, you would have to solve the Mukhanov equation for a given inflation thing. But what you will rather say to get some estimate what this is, you say, well, I really have something like a De Sitter expansion for most of the time. And then at the end of this De Sitter expansion, I will just terminate it somehow so that my inflation actually finishes. So the first approximation, you will just model, again, any inflation by the De Sitter expansion. Okay, so using De Sitter approximation, again, You know that fk square is whatever I wrote over there, is something like 1 over 2k cubed eta square. It's a bit over there. And then a square is 1 over eta square 8 square. And so the power spectrum, so EZK, which is FK square over Z square, and Z square is 2A square M Planck square epsilon. But it has that epsilon in it. Okay, and that's very, very important. So you are getting this is 1 over 4K cube, and then 8 square divided by M Planck square and epsilon. And you are interested in this power spectrum when the inflation finished. So exactly at the time when the mode freezes, when the horizon exits. Okay, so this is at T equal to T star, which is when the horizon actually exits. So horizon exits. So notice two things. So first of all, the horizon exits. So this seems like you are really getting scale invariant spectrum, 1 over kq, right? But it's not so. Because for different k, the horizon, the mode exits at different times. So actually, this exit time t star, so remember when we were plotting this thing here, so this was the horizon ha, and then we have, for 1k, we have this thing here. And then it's frozen. And then for the other k, you have this thing here. So they actually happen at different t star, right? So actually, the t star is k dependent. Okay. So this is not a scale invariant spectrum, but it's almost scale invariant spectrum if you have nearby k's. Okay. But t star depends on k. Okay. So that's first thing to notice is that. Although it seems scale invariant, it's not really scale invariant because there's an extra k dependence hiding in this t star. So second thing is really the appearance of this epsilon. So remember, small is an epsilon, epsilon is a small parameter, right? So you see that actually if you didn't have epsilon, this would be some quantity, but if you have epsilon, this is much, much bigger quantity. So the presence of epsilon presents of 1 over epsilon actually enhances the mode. So if you look at the gravitational perturbations of gamma ij, they don't have that epsilon. So you know, the power spectrum will look very, very, very similar, but it will not have that 1 over epsilon factor. And what it tells you is that if the inflation theory is right, then actually the gravitational waves are actually suppressed with respect to the scalar modes by this 1 over epsilon factor. Okay, so enhances the mode, but this is only for scalars. Okay, so now let's do the painful calculation of the spectral index in this case. So let's really try to say what is this dependence of T star on K. Okay, so let us calculate the spectral index. And so for that, I have to really use the fact that the T star is defined by saying that the K is equal to HA at T star. Okay, so this is my condition when T star happens. Okay, so now what you can do is that you can differentiate this equation with respect to K. And so you are getting, so if you differentiate this with respect to K, you get 1. And then you get T dH over dK A plus h dA over dK. So now you write dH over dK, d over dK as d over dT, dT over dK. Now dH over dT is just h dot, and then you have dT over dK and A, and the same thing you do with the other term, so it's plus h A dot dT over dK. And so you can actually say what this dT over dK is. So this is equal to dT over dK. And then you have h dot a. And then a dot over a is another h, so you can write it plus h square and times a. Okay? So this is certainly true, and that's my condition when the horizon exits. Okay. So in other words, you can write k times dt over dk. Now I multiply by k as, okay. So that's k divided by h dot a plus h square a. So now I want to use the definition of my Slobodov parameter epsilon, which is minus h dot over h square. Okay, so you see that there is this h dot. So now you divide it by h square, and you multiply by h square, and so and k at the same time is h a. Okay, so this is h a. And then you put h square here, and you have h dot over h square, and you put h here, and then plus 1, something like this. And so this is no surprise that this is equal to 1 over h, 1 minus epsilon. Okay? So that was a technical preparation for calculation of the spectral index. So now you just use the formula for what the spectral index is. And so ls, as we defined it last time, was equal to 1 plus some derivatives. So k d over dk of logarithm k cube of p. Okay, so this is how we define ns, the spectral index. So now using what k times d over dk is this thing here. Okay, so I can write it using that formula here as 1 over h, 1 minus epsilon, and then d over dt of, and then k cube p, plugging what p is just h square over 4 m Planck square epsilon. Okay, so now you just have to differentiate this h.
Log.
Huh?
One question.
Oh, log, yes. Yeah.
So, and maybe I'm mixing stuff, but at some point, we were using that during inflation, h kind of stays the same. But we are not taking that to be sharp assumption,
so
right?
So what you are using here is that what you are basically saying, well, the inflation for all, you are using Desiderate approximation. Just like you are saying, for all the time the inflation actually lasted, we had Desiderate expansion.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the inflation, this is not true anymore. So what we want to calculate, of course, is this power spectrum and the spectral index at the end of inflation.
Yeah.
Okay. So for this, actually, you are not using h equals to constant, because this is, you are calculating these quantities at the time the mode actually, you know, leaves the horizon.
Okay.
So that's like, you know, it's an approximation, of course, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, epsilon is still small, so we can think that h dot is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It will be related to epsilon, which is okay. So now you really have to do this derivative of the logarithm, and if you do it, you find that this is equal to 1 minus epsilon, and then 2 h dot h square, and then minus epsilon dot, I don't know where that comes from, but somewhere in the derivatives, epsilon dot h epsilon. I just remind you that we had another slow roll parameter which was called eta. Okay, so we had the epsilon which was minus h dot over h square, but we had also eta, which now, to distinguish it from conformal time, I'll call it eta r. And that was defined to be epsilon dot over h epsilon. So you remember probably this guy here. And that was also much, much more than 1. Okay, so now we can write this in terms of the eta. So this is equal to minus 2 epsilon plus eta divided by 1 minus epsilon, eta r. Okay, and neglecting the epsilon, so this is already small, that is already small. So neglecting the epsilon into the denominator, just getting that this is minus 2 epsilon minus eta r. And we have also another parameter delta, which is again screwed up. But anyway, so all these parameters are small. So what you are predicting is actually that the right hand side here is negative. Okay? So really, you predicted that ns is equal to 1 minus 2 epsilon minus eta r. And so you are predicting red tilted spectrum. So hooray, so that's great. So really, you are out of the inflation theory. You are getting that the spectrum shouldn't be exactly scale invariant, but should be red tilted as what you observe. Okay. So now you can do the similar calculation for tensors. But I have to leave you something to do it for your homework. So I'll not do it really here. So the only difference is that now you have, you know, tensor things. So you have to expand your modes in the, you know, tensor components. And so you have two possible spins. So you have two components of these things here. So anyway, what you should find is that the spectrum of P of gamma, again, given by F of k square divided by z square, but now z square is something different, and you can read it in the notes and then compare with your homework. And what you're finding here is that this is given by q a square k cube. Again, this is in the De Sitter approximation, m Planck square, and at t equal to t star. So that's your prediction for the power spectrum of gravitational waves, if you want. So now if you compare it with really the direction for scale waves, there is some different factor. There's this 1 over 4 missing, but also, most importantly, the epsilon is missing. So these are, you know, suppressed with respect to the scale waves. Okay? And then if you calculate, again, the spectral index, so n for gamma, okay, one more thing. Sorry for that. So this is for 1 degree of freedom. 1 degree of freedom. So now you know that you have 2 degrees of freedom for gravity waves. So the power spectrum, interesting, is actually not, okay, doesn't matter. the power spectrum is actually twice that. So sometimes people define the power for the tensors, and this is 2 times phi of gamma. Okay, and then you would define the tensor spectral index, and historically that comes with all that 1. So you are just interested how it differs from 0. Okay, so it's just given by k in 5 minutes. Thank you. k over dk logarithm k cube pt. And if you calculate that, and that's part of your homework, you find minus 2 epsilon. So again, you find that this guy should be smaller than 0. So again, it should be red-tilted. But it's different red-tilted than the scalar mode. Okay? But of course, nobody ever observed gravitational waves coming from the inflation yet. Right? So people couldn't verify this. But this is something predicted by inflation. And if people observe these things, then this would be actually interesting to compare. So finally, what you may hear people discussing is the ratio of the power spectrum of the tensors with respect to the power spectrum of the scalars. So Pt and P zeta. And so if you just divide these two, what you find that this is, should be equal to 16 epsilon. So if the theory of single field slow roll inflation is correct, then the tensors really should be suppressed by the power of epsilon with respect to the scalars. Okay, so now this was the problem with the bicep. So when bicep measured these gravitational waves in the BB polarization of CMB, they said that this ratio is something like 0.2. Okay, so that would be a really, really strong signal for gravitational waves. They said, well, we see the gravitational waves. But actually, this is probably not true, and it wouldn't be consistent, this thing here, because epsilon has to be small. Okay, so that would immediately rule out the single field slow roll inflation as we have it here. But the truth is that this effect went away, and actually people now place it something like 0.01, or maybe even smaller. So this is probably a more reasonable estimate for what this R is probably at this point. But anyway, if it's bigger than 0.01, people should be able to see it in nearby experiments. Okay, so you will play with this a little bit more in your homework. I have 15 minutes, so let me just briefly summarize what we learned about the universe, and then I will show you some small slideshow. And so basically, the universe at this point, the current understanding of the universe is really understood in terms of the 6 parameters. Are there any questions for this? All right, so summary of current cosmological model. And we basically talk about everything except one parameter. So I told you that the current cosmological model is lambda CDM model. So we need cosmological constant, and we need cold dark matter. And so it is not surprising that there are some 3 parameters are related really to the matter content of the universe. So the first 3 is just omega b, which is the baryon density, rho over rho critical. So baryon density. Then omega cold dark matter is how much dark matter we have. We know that this is something like 4%, this is something like 25% or whatever. And then how much lambda we have. So dark energy, cold dark matter. And so these are 3 out of these 6 parameters. And they very well describe basically the homogeneous universe, right? So history of homogeneous universe is basically very well captured by these 3 parameters. So knowing these 3 parameters, I can say how the universe looks like on a homogeneous scale. Okay, so now there are 2 more parameters regarding inhomogeneities, and these are precisely the primordial amplitude of power spectrum, so that is A0, and there is the spectral index NS. So these are primordial fluctuations. And you know, in the picture I presented, is that it's believed that these primordial fluctuations, which are originally quantum mechanical and you know, in that sense very simple, actually gave rise to all the structure formation and all the galaxies and stuff like that. So all the inhomogeneities in the universe can be sort of described by knowing this, the amplitude A0 and the spectral parameter NS. Yeah?
The amplitude A0 was the time, it's the amplitude at some time T0, right?
Yeah.
So what's T0?
Or you can choose anything you want, right? So, so you know that your power spectrum goes like 1 over k, some power ns, and something like that.
Yeah.
And so all you need to know is how this power spectrum looked like at some instant of time. And then, you know, that gives you an amplitude at that instant of time, and then you know how the amplitude evolved in time later on. Yeah, so usually take this k0, let's say at the end of inflation, you would say, well, what is the magnitude of... But yeah, but you can basically, you know, choose one instant of time, and you know. So finally, there is the last parameter, which is called tau, and I haven't discussed that at all. But it's called reionization parameter, or optical depth. And so together, all these things are 6 parameters, which basically describe everything which is observed. So now what this guy does is basically, I told you that once the CMB was released, you know, after this scattering actually finished, or after, you know, the plasma release, then most of the photons actually never scattered with anything else. So this is not true. So what actually happened after that is that once you start forming things which are hot, like stars or, you know, centers of galaxies or whatever, then you have some high energetic objects, and these can reionize your photons again. So the photons can start bumping into this ionized thing, and so this is basically described by this parameter tau. So that's the last parameter, which I'm not going to discuss, but which is there. So you really need to put this guy here. On the other hand, all the other parameters seem to be like naturally defined. So at this point, the observation is consistent with saying that actually there are no tensor modes produced in inflation. So basically what you are saying is that you are taking this, you can take that there are no gravity waves, you can take R equal to 0, and it will be consistent with all the observation. So that's, for example, one parameter which can be deduced. Another assumption here is that, for example, you are taking that the curvature of the universe is flat, so k equal to 0, and so on. So, but anyway, so these are really the 6 parameters which are non-trivial, and all the observations are basically consistent with just these 6 parameters. Okay, so can I get the screen, please? And let's see if this works this time. Thank you. Maybe we can make it dark so that it's nicer. Thank you. And let's see if there is anything there. 17, 16. So anyway, I just prepared this final propaganda for the course. So it's really nothing deep, but let's have some fun. And then let's hope and pray. Yes. No. Yes. No. I will not touch it. Okay, so the whole course was about our universe, and and so about galaxies and how we observe that. And so we learned that basically on the large scale structure, the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. And you can see it nicely here. So what is displayed here is the nearby galaxies and you know how they move with respect to us. So you can see the colors that they are moving with respect to, you know, coming closer or coming away from us. And it's because it's local thing, you really observe some of them are really coming at you. But if you are going further and further away, they'll be all expanding, and that's the proof that the universe is expanding. Okay, so we had the homogeneous and isotropic universe. And then you know that this is composed basically by these elements now. So you have like 4% of baryonic matter, and then you have 23% of dark matter, and then the rest is dark energy. And actually dark energy has taken over very recently and it really governs. So now we discuss the thermal history. In particular, we discuss, you know, how the atoms were formed and how helium was actually created in the early universe and so on, and how the, you know, structure formation started, although I haven't discussed really that structure formation. So we discussed the thermal history. And then we discussed the inhomogeneities, right? And so the inhomogeneities basically starting from inflation and quantum fluctuations and how they sort of, you know, survive all the way to CMB, time when it was released. And then it's believed that these actually gave rise to the structure formation as you see it now. And of course, it would be great if we could observe some gravitational waves coming directly from, you know, from this inflation period. That would be great, but at this point, they are not observed. Okay? And as I said, you know, everything at this point can be fitted by just 6 parameters. And so all this beautiful CMB spectrum and everything can be just fitted by 6 parameters over here. And you can download some Boltzmann codes and you can start playing with the values of these parameters, and it will give you some nice pictures of what this CMB would look like if you change the value of one parameter with respect to another and so on. Okay? So now, finally, I have a quiz for you. So this is our current observation, our current understanding of the universe. But then the question is, this was the understanding of the universe some time ago. So can you guess which country or which region this originates from? So, okay, so first guess.
Egypt,
very good. So this comes from the ancient Egypt. And so that's the understanding of the universe in ancient Egypt. This one. So maybe the picture is not so clear, but there's this raven who basically dived into the sea and brought up a shell. And in that shell, there was a little bit of earth, and that's how the earth was created. And he also, in that shell, there were these people, and that's us. So how, you know, how we came into being. So any suggestions? Any Canadians here? So this is actually the Haida culture. So it's the Native American idea. And so if you go to Vancouver, they have this beautiful statue there. So this one, any guesses? We have Underworld, we have everything there. So this would be like ancient Greece, or you know maybe also Persia and you know around there. Okay, here, that's very simple.
Mayans.
Uh-huh, that's ancient Maya. And so we come to our current understanding, and so that's contemporary England due to Terry Pratchett. So thank you so much for attending this course. I hope you had fun, and good luck in your future endeavors. Questions?
How can we measure the turtle? Measure the turtle.
Measure?
Yeah. Well, it's there, like.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so I don't know if you read Terry Pratchett, but but they have scientists there as well. And so, for example, they were lowering themselves in down this core and trying to find the sex of the turtle, for example. and the idea is that there's many turtles in the universe, and they finally go to some final mating place, and they know that there'll be like a big crunch or something like that for the universe. But it's very nice theory. Okay, thanks.